friends, allies, complete strangers, losing their lives for the Mockingjay. Let me go on alone. Lead them off. I'll transfer the hollow to Jackson. The rest of you can finish the mission. No one's going to agree to that, says Jackson in exasperation. We're wasting time, says Finnick. Listen, Peeta whispers. The screams have stopped, and in their absence my name has rebounded, startling in its proximity. It's below as well as behind us now. Katniss! I nudge Pollux on the shoulder and we start to run. Trouble is, we had planned to descend to a lower level, but that's out now. When we come to the steps leading down, Pollux and I are scanning for a possible alternative on the hollow when I start gagging. Masks on, orders Jackson. There's no need for masks. Everyone is breathing the same air. I'm the only one losing my stew because I'm the only one reacting to the odor. Drifting up from the stairwell, cutting through the sewage. Roses. I begin to tremble. I swerve away from the smell and stumble right out onto the transfer. Smooth, pastel-colored, tiled streets, just like the ones above, but bordered by white brick walls instead of homes. A roadway where delivery vehicles can drive with ease without the congestion of the capital, empty now of everything but us. I swing up my bow and blow up the first pod with an explosive arrow which kills the nest of flesh-eating rats inside. Then I sprint for the next intersection, where I know one false step will cause the ground beneath our feet to disintegrate, feeding us into something labeled meat grinder. I shout a warning to the others to stay with me. I plan for us to skirt around the corner and then detonate the meat grinder, but another unmarked pod lies in wait. It happens silently. I would miss it entirely if Finnick didn't pull me to a stop. Katniss! I whip back around, arrow poised for flight. But what can be done? Two of Gale's arrows already lie useless beside the wide shaft of golden light that radiates from ceiling to floor. Inside, Masala is as still as a statue, poised up on the ball of one foot, head tilted back, held captive by the beam. I can't tell if he's yelling, although his mouth is stretched wide. We watch, utterly helpless, as the flesh melts off his body like candle wax. Can't help him, Peeta starts shoving people forward. Can't. Amazingly, he's the only one still functional enough to get us moving. I don't know why he's in control when he should be flipping out and bashing my brains in, but that could happen any second. At the pressure of his hand against my shoulder, I turn away from the grisly thing that was Masala. I make my feet go forward, fast, so fast that I can barely skid to a stop before the next intersection. A spray of gunfire brings down a shower of plaster. I jerk my head from side to side, looking for the pod, before I turn and see the squad of peacekeepers pounding down the transfer toward us. With the meat grinder pod blocking our way, there's nothing to do but fire back. They outnumber us 2-1, but we've still got 6 original members of the Star Squad who aren't trying to run and shoot at the same time. Fish in a barrel, I think, as blossoms of red stain their white uniforms. 3/4 of them are down and dead, when more begin to pour in from the side of the tunnel, the same one I flung myself through to get away from the smell, from the... Those aren't peacekeepers. They are white, four-limbed, about the size of a full-grown human, but that's where the comparisons stop. Naked, with long reptilian tails, arched backs, and heads that jut forward. They swarm over the peacekeepers, living and dead, clamp onto their necks with their mouths and rip off the helmeted heads. Apparently, having a capital pedigree is as useless here as it was in 13. It seems to take only seconds before the peacekeepers are decapitated. The mutts fall to their bellies and skitter toward us on all fours. "This way!" I shout, hugging the wall and making a sharp right turn to avoid the pod. When everyone's joined me, I fire into the intersection and the meat grinder activates. Huge mechanical teeth burst through the street and chew the tile to dust. That should make it impossible for the mutts to follow us, but I don't know. The wolf and monkey mutts I've encountered could leap unbelievably far. The hissing burns my ears, and the reek of roses makes the walls spin. I grab Pollux's arm. "Forget the mission! What's the quickest way above ground?" There's no time for checking the hollow. We follow Pollux for about 10 yards along the transfer and go through a doorway. I'm aware of tile changing to concrete, of crawling through a tight, stinking pipe onto a ledge about a foot wide. We're in the main sewer. A yard below, a poisonous brew of human waste, garbage, and chemical runoff bubbles by us. Parts of the surface are on fire, others emit evil-looking clouds of vapor. One look tells you that if you fall in, you're never coming out. Moving as quickly as we dare on the slippery ledge, we make our way to a narrow bridge and cross it. In an alcove at the far side, Pollux smacks a ladder with his hand and points up the shaft. "This is it, our way out." A quick glance at our party tells me something's off. "Wait, where are Jackson and League One?"
"They stayed at the grinder to hold the mutts back," says Holmes.
"What?" I'm lunging back for the bridge, willing to leave no one to those monsters, when he yanks me back.
"Don't waste their lives, Katniss. It's too late for them. Look."
Holmes nods to the pipe where the mutts are slithering onto the ledge.
"Stand back!" Gale shouts.
With his explosive-tipped arrows, he rips the far side of the bridge from its foundation. The rest sinks into the bubbles just as the mutts reach it. For the first time, I get a good look at them. A mix of human and lizard, and who knows what else. White, tight reptilian skin smeared with gore, clawed hands and feet, their faces a mess of conflicting features, hissing, shrieking my name now as their bodies contort in rage, lashing out with tails and claws, taking huge chunks of one another or their own bodies with wide, lathered mouths, driven mad by their need to destroy me. My scent must be as evocative to them as theirs is to me, more so because despite its toxicity, the mutts begin to throw themselves into the foul sewer. Along our bank, everyone opens fire. I choose my arrows without discretion, sending arrowheads, fire, explosives into the mutts' bodies. They're mortal, but only just. No natural thing could keep coming with 2 dozen bullets in it. Yes, we can eventually kill them, only there are so many, an endless supply pouring from the pipe, not even hesitating to take to the sewage. But it's not their numbers that make my hands shake so. No mud is good. All are meant to damage you. Some take your life, like the monkeys, others your reason, like the tracker jackers. However, the true atrocities, the most frightening, incorporate a perverse psychological twist designed to terrify the victim. The sight of the wolf mutts with the dead tribute's eyes, the sound of the jabberjays replicating Prim's tortured screams, the smell of Snow's roses mixed with the victim's blood, carried across the sewer, cutting through even this foulness, making my heart run wild, my skin turn to ice, my lungs unable to suck air. It's as if Snow's breathing right in my face, telling me it's time to die. The others are shouting at me, but I can't seem to respond. Strong arms lift me as I blast the head off a mutt whose claws have just grazed my ankle. I'm slammed into the ladder, hands shoved against the rungs, ordered to climb. My wooden puppet limbs obey. Movement slowly brings me back to my senses. I detect one person above me. Pollux, Peeta and Cressida are below. We reach a platform, switch to a second ladder, rungs slick with sweat and mildew. At the next platform, my head has cleared, and the reality of what's happened hits me. I begin frantically pulling people up off the ladder. Peeta, Cressida. That's it. What have I done? What have I abandoned the others to? I'm scrambling back down the ladder when one of my boots kicks someone. Climb! Gale barks at me. I'm back up, hauling him in, peering into the gloom for more. No! Gale turns my face to him and shakes his head, uniform shredded, gaping wound in the side of his neck. There's a human cry from below. Someone's still alive, I plead. No, Katniss, they're not coming, says Gale. Only the mutts are. Unable to accept it, I shine the light from Cressida's gun down the shaft. Far below, I can just make out Finnick, struggling to hang on as three mutts tear at him, as one yanks back his head to take the death bite. Something bizarre happens. It's as if I'm Finnick, watching images of my life flash by. The mast of a boat, a silver parachute, Mags laughing, a pink sky, Beatty's trident, Annie in her wedding dress, waves breaking over rocks. Then it's over. I slide the hollow from my belt and choke out, Nightlock, Nightlock, Nightlock. Release it. Hunch against the wall with the others as the explosion rocks the platform and bits of mutt and human flesh shoot out of the pipe and shower us. There's a clank as Pollux slams a cover over the pipe and locks it in place. Pollux, Gale, Cressida, Peeta, and me. We're all that's left. Later, the human feelings will come. Now I'm conscious only of an animal need to keep the remnants of our band alive. We can't stop here. Someone comes up with a bandage. We tie it around Gale's neck, get him to his feet. Only one figure stays huddled against the wall. Peeta, I say. There's no response. Has he blacked out? I crouch in front of him, pulling his cuffed hands from his face. Peeta! His eyes are like black pools, the pupils dilated so that the blue irises have all but vanished. The muscles in his wrists are hard as metal. Leave me, he whispers. I can't hang on. Yes, you can, I tell him. Peeta shakes his head. I'm losing it. I'll go mad, like them. Like the mutts, like a rabid beast bent on ripping my throat out. And here, finally here, in this place, in these circumstances, I will really have to kill him, and Snow will win. Hot, bitter hatred courses through me. Snow has won too much already today. It's a long shot. It's suicide, maybe. But I do the only thing I can think of. I lean in and kiss Peeta full on the mouth. His whole body starts shuddering, but I keep my lips pressed to his until I have to come up for air. My hands slide up his wrists to clasp his. Don't let him take you from me. Peeta's panting hard as he fights the nightmares raging in his head. No, I don't want to. I clench his hands to the point of pain. Stay with me. His pupils contract to pinpoints, dilate again rapidly, and then return to something resembling normalcy. Always, he murmurs. I help Peeta up and address Pollux. How far to the street? He indicates it's just above us. I climb the last ladder and push open the lid to someone's utility room. I'm rising to my feet when a woman throws open the door. She wears a bright turquoise silk robe embroidered with exotic birds. Her magenta hair's fluffed up like a cloud and decorated with gilded butterflies. Grease from the half-eaten sausage she's holding smears her lipstick. The expression on her face says she recognizes me. She opens her mouth to call for help.
Without hesitation, I shoot her through the heart. Mockingjay, Disc 9. Chapter 23. Who the woman was calling to remains a mystery, because after searching the apartment, we find she was alone. Perhaps her cry was meant for a nearby neighbor, or was simply an expression of fear. At any rate, there's no one else to hear her. This apartment would be a classy place to hole up in for a while, but that's a luxury we can't afford. How long do you think we have before they figure out some of us could have survived? I ask. I think they could be here any time, Gail answers. They knew we were heading for the streets. Probably the explosion will throw them for a few minutes, then they'll start looking for our exit point. I go to a window that overlooks the street, and when I peek through the blinds, I'm not faced with peacekeepers, but a bundled crowd of people going about their business. During our underground journey, we have left the evacuated zones far behind and surfaced in a busy section of the capital. This crowd offers our only chance of escape. I don't have a hollow, but I have Cressida. She joins me at the window, confirms she knows our location, and gives me the good news that we aren't many blocks from the president's mansion. One glance at my companions tells me this is no time for a stealth attack on Snow. Gail's still losing blood from the neck wound, which we haven't even cleaned. Peter's sitting on a velvet sofa with his teeth clamped down on a pillow, either fighting off madness or containing a scream. Pollux weeps against the mantle of an ornate fireplace. Cressida stands determinedly at my side, but she's so pale her lips are bloodless. I'm running on hate. When the energy for that ebbs, I'll be worthless. Let's check her closets, I say. In one bedroom we find hundreds of women's outfits, coats, pairs of shoes, a rainbow of wigs, enough makeup to paint a house. In a bedroom across the hall, there's a similar selection for men. Perhaps they belong to her husband, perhaps to a lover who had the good luck to be out this morning. I call the others to dress. At the sight of Peeta's bloody wrists, I dig in my pocket for the handcuff key, but he jerks away from me. No, he says, don't. They help hold me together. You might need your hands, says Gail. When I feel myself slipping, I dig my wrists into them, and the pain helps me focus, says Peeta. I let them be. Fortunately, it's cold out, so we can conceal most of our uniforms and weapons under flowing coats and cloaks. We hang our boots around our necks by their laces and hide them, pull on silly shoes to replace them. The real challenge, of course, is our faces. Cressida and Pollux run the risk of being recognized by acquaintances. Gail could be familiar from the propos and news, and Peeta and I are known by every citizen of Panem. We hastily help one another apply thick layers of makeup, pull on wigs and sunglasses. Cressida wraps scarves over Peeta's and my mouths and noses. I can feel the clock ticking away, but stop for just a few moments to stuff pockets with food and first aid supplies. Stay together, I say at the front door. Then we march right into the street. Snow flurries have begun to fall. Agitated people swirl around us, speaking of rebels and hunger, and me in their affected capital accents. We cross the street, pass a few more apartments. Just as we turn the corner, 3 dozen peacekeepers sweep past us. We hop out of their way, as the real citizens do, wait until the crowd returns to its normal flow, and keep moving. Cressida, I whisper, can you think of anywhere? I'm trying, she says. We cover another block, and the sirens begin. Through an apartment window, I see an emergency report and pictures of our faces flashing. They haven't identified who in our party died yet, because I see Castor and Finnick among the photos. Soon every passerby will be as dangerous as a peacekeeper. Cressida! There's one place. It's not ideal, but we can try it, she says. We follow her a few more blocks and turn through a gate into what looks like a private residence. It's some kind of shortcut, though, because after walking through a manicured garden,
We come out of another gate onto a small back street that connects two main avenues. There are a few pokey stores, one that buys used goods, another that sells fake jewelry. Only a couple of people are around, and they pay no attention to us. Cressida begins to babble in a high-pitched voice about fur undergarments, how essential they are during the cold months.
Wait until you see the prices. Believe me, it's half what you pay on the avenues.
We stop before a grimy storefront filled with mannequins in furry underwear. The place doesn't even look open, but Cressida pushes through the front door, setting off a dissonant chiming. Inside the dim, narrow shop lined with racks of merchandise, the smell of pelts fills my nose. Business must be slow, since we're the only customers. Cressida heads straight for a hunched figure sitting in the back. I follow, trailing my fingers through the soft garments as we go. Behind a counter sits the strangest person I've ever seen. She's an extreme example of surgical enhancement gone wrong. For surely not even in the capital could they find this face attractive. The skin has been pulled back tightly and tattooed with black and gold stripes. The nose has been flattened until it barely exists. I've seen cat whiskers on people in the capital before, but none so long. The result is a grotesque, semi-feline mask, which now squints at us distrustfully. Cressida takes off her wig, revealing her vines.
"Tigress," she says, "we need help."
Tigress. Deep in my brain, the name rings a bell. She was a fixture, a younger, less disturbing version of herself in the earliest Hunger Games I can remember. A stylist, I think. I don't remember for which district, not 12. Then she must have had one operation too many and crossed the line into repellents. So this is where stylists go when they've outlived their use, to sad theme underwear shops where they wait for death out of the public eye. I stare at her face, wondering if her parents actually named her Tigress, inspiring her mutilation, or if she chose the style and changed her name to match her stripes.
"Plutarch said you could be trusted," adds Cressida.
Great. She's one of Plutarch's people. So if her first move isn't to turn us into the capital, it will be to notify Plutarch, and by extension, Coyne, of our whereabouts. No, Tigress's shop is not ideal, but it's all we have at the moment, if she'll even help us. She's peering between an old television on her counter and us, as if trying to place us. To help her, I pull down my scarf, remove my wig, and step closer so that the light on the screen falls on my face. Tigress gives a low growl, not unlike one Buttercup might greet me with. She slinks down off her stool and disappears behind a rack of fur-lined leggings. There's a sound of sliding, and then her hand emerges and waves us forward. Cressida looks at me, as if to ask, "Are you sure? But what choice do we have? Returning to the streets under these conditions guarantees our capture or death." I push around the furs and find Tigress has slid back a panel at the base of the wall. Behind it seems to be the top of a steep stone stairway. She gestures for me to enter. Everything about the situation screams trap. I have a moment of panic and find myself turning to Tigress, searching those tawny eyes. Why is she doing this? She's no sinner, someone willing to sacrifice herself for others. This woman was the embodiment of capital shallowness. She was one of the stars of the Hunger Games until she wasn't. So is that it, then? Bitterness? Hatred? Revenge? Actually, I'm comforted by the idea. A need for revenge can burn long and hot, especially if every glance in a mirror reinforces it.
"Did Snow ban you from the games?" I ask.
She just stares back at me. Somewhere her tiger tail flicks with displeasure. "Because I'm going to kill him, you know." Her mouth spreads into what I take for a smile, reassured
that this isn't complete madness, I crawl through the space. About halfway down the steps, my face runs into a hanging chain, and I pull it, illuminating the hideout with a flickering fluorescent bulb. It's a small cellar with no doors or windows, shallow and wide. Probably just a strip between two real basements, a place whose existence could go unnoticed unless you had a very keen eye for dimensions. It's cold and dank, with piles of pelts that I'm guessing haven't seen the light of day in years. Unless Tigris gives us up, I don't believe anyone will find us here. By the time I reach the concrete floor, my companions are on the steps. The panel slides back in place. I hear the underwear rack being adjusted on squeaky wheels, Tigris padding back to her stool. We have been swallowed up by her store. Just in time, too, because Gale looks on the verge of collapse. We make a bed of pelts, strip off his layers of weapons, and help him onto his back. At the end of the cellar, there's a faucet about a foot from the floor with a drain under it. I turn the tap, and after much sputtering and a lot of rust, clear water begins to flow. We clean Gale's neck wound, and I realize bandages won't be enough. He's going to need a few stitches. There's a needle and sterile thread in the first aid supplies, but what we lack is a healer. It crosses my mind to enlist Tigris. As a stylist, she must know how to work a needle, but that would leave no one manning the shop, and she's doing enough already. I accept that I'm probably the most qualified for the job, grit my teeth, and put in a row of jagged sutures. It's not pretty, but it's functional. I smear it with medicine and wrap it up, give him some painkillers. You can rest now. It's safe here, I tell him. He goes out like a light. While Cressida and Pollux make fur nests for each of us, I attend to Peeta's wrists, gently rinsing away the blood, putting on an antiseptic, and bandaging them beneath the cuffs. You've got to keep them clean, otherwise the infection could spread and—
I know what blood poisoning is, Katniss, says Peeta, even if my mother isn't a healer.
I'm jolted back in time, to another wound, another set of bandages. You said that same thing to me in the first Hunger Games. Real or not real?
Real, he says.
And you risked your life getting the medicine that saved me?
Real, I shrug.
You were the reason I was alive to do it.
Was I?
The comment throws him into confusion. Some shiny memory must be fighting for his attention, because his body tenses and his newly bandaged wrists strain against the metal cuffs. Then all the energy saps from his body.
I'm so tired, Katniss.
Go to sleep, I say. He won't until I've rearranged his handcuffs and shackled him to one of the stair supports. It can't be comfortable, lying there with his arms above his head, but in a few minutes he drifts off too. Cressida and Pollux have made beds for us, arranged our food and medical supplies, and now ask what I want to do about setting up a guard. I look at Gale's pallor, Peeta's restraints. Pollux hasn't slept for days, and Cressida and I only napped for a few hours. If a troop of peacekeepers were to come through that door, we'd be trapped like rats. We are completely at the mercy of a decrepit tiger woman with what I can only hope is an all-consuming passion for Snow's death. I don't honestly think there's any point in setting up a guard. Let's just try to get some sleep, I say. They nod numbly, and we all burrow into our pelts. The fire inside me has flickered out, and with it my strength. I surrender to the soft, musty fur and oblivion. I have only one dream I remember, a long and wearying thing, in which I'm trying to get to District 12. The home I'm seeking is intact, the people alive. Effie Trinket, conspicuous, in a bright pink wig and tailored outfit, travels with me. I keep trying to ditch her in places, but she inexplicably reappears at my side.
insisting that as my escort, she's responsible for my staying on schedule. Only the schedule is constantly shifting, derailed by our lack of a stamp from an official, or delayed when Effie breaks one of her high heels. We camp for days on a bench in a gray station in District 7, awaiting a train that never comes. When I wake, somehow I feel even more drained by this than my usual nighttime forays into blood and terror. Cressida, the only person awake, tells me it's late afternoon. I eat a can of beef stew and wash it down with a lot of water. Then I lean against the cellar wall, retracing the events of the last day, moving death by death, counting them up on my fingers. 1, 2, Mitchell and Boggs lost on the block. 3, Masala melted by the pod. 4, 5, League 1 and Jackson sacrificing themselves at the meat grinder. 6, 7, 8, Castor, Holmes, and Finnick being decapitated by the rose-scented lizard mutts. 8 dead in 24 hours. I know it happened, and yet it doesn't seem real. Surely Castor is asleep under that pile of furs. Finnick will come bounding down the steps in a minute. Boggs will tell me his plan for our escape. To believe them dead is to accept I killed them. Okay, maybe not Mitchell and Boggs. They died on an actual assignment, but the others lost their lives defending me on a mission I fabricated. My plot to assassinate Snow seems so stupid now, so stupid as I sit shivering here in this cellar, tallying up our losses, fingering the tassels on the silver knee-high boots I stole from the woman's home. Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. I killed her, too. I'm taking out unarmed citizens now. I think it's time I give myself up. When everyone finally awakens, I confess how I lied about the mission, how I jeopardized everyone in pursuit of revenge. There's a long silence after I finish. Then Gale says, "Katniss, we all knew you were lying about Coin sending you to assassinate Snow." "You knew, maybe. The soldiers from 13 didn't," I reply. "Do you really think Jackson believed you had orders from Coin?" Cressida asks. "Of course she didn't. But she trusted Boggs, and he clearly wanted you to go on." "I never even told Boggs what I planned to do," I say. "You told everyone in command," Gale says. "It was one of your conditions for being the Mockingjay. I kill Snow." Those seem like two disconnected things. Negotiating with Coin for the privilege of executing Snow after the war, and this unauthorized flight through the capital. "But not like this," I say. "It's been a complete disaster." "I think it would be considered a highly successful mission," says Gale. "We've infiltrated the enemy camp, showing that the capital's defenses can be breached. We've managed to get footage of ourselves all over the capital's news. We've thrown the whole city into chaos trying to find us." "Trust me, Plutarch's thrilled," Cressida adds. "That's because Plutarch doesn't care who dies," I say. "Not as long as his games are a success." Cressida and Gale go round and round, trying to convince me. Pollux nods at their words to back them up. Only Peeta doesn't offer an opinion. "What do you think, Peeta?" I finally ask him.
"I think you still have no idea the effect you can have."
He slides his cuffs up the support and pushes himself to a sitting position.
"None of the people we lost were idiots. They knew what they were doing. They followed you because they believed you really could kill Snow."
I don't know why his voice reaches me when no one else's can. But if he's right, and I think he is, I owe the others a debt that can only be repaid in one way. I pull my paper map from a pocket in my uniform and spread it out on the floor with new resolve. "Where are we, Cressida?"
Tigress's shop sits about 5 blocks from the city circle and Snow's mansion.
We're in easy walking distance through a zone in which the pods are deactivated for the residents' safety. We have disguises that, perhaps with some embellishments from Tigress's furry stock, could get us safely there. But then what? The mansion's sure to be heavily guarded, under round-the-clock camera surveillance, and laced with pods that could become live at the flick of a switch.
What we need is to get him out in the open, Gale says to me. Then one of us could pick him off.
Does he ever appear in public anymore? Asks Peeta.
I don't think so, says Cressida. At least, in all the recent speeches I've seen, he's been in the mansion. Even before the rebels got here, I imagine he became more vigilant after Finnick aired his crimes.
That's right. It's not just the tigresses of the capital who hate Snow now, but a web of people who know what he did to their friends and family. It would have to be something bordering on miraculous to lure him out. Something like,
I bet he'd come out for me, I say, if I were captured. He'd want that as public as possible. He'd want my execution on his front steps.
I let this sink in. Then Gale could shoot him from the audience.
No,
Peeta shakes his head. There are too many alternative endings to that plan. Snow might decide to keep you and torture information out of you, or have you executed publicly without being present, or kill you inside the mansion and display your body out front.
Gale,
I say.
It seems like an extreme solution to jump to immediately, he says. Maybe, if all else fails. Let's keep thinking.
In the quiet that follows, we hear Tigress's soft footfall overhead. It must be closing time. She's locking up, fastening the shutters, maybe. A few minutes later, the panel at the top of the stairs slides open.
Come up, says a gravelly voice. I have some food for you.
It's the first time she's talked since we arrived. Whether it's natural or from years of practice, I don't know, but there's something in her manner of speaking that suggests a cat's purr. As we climb the stairs, Cressida asks, Did you contact Plutarch, Tigress?
No way to,
Tigress shrugs.
He'll figure out you're in a safe house. Don't worry.
Worry? I feel immensely relieved by the news that I won't be given, and have to ignore, direct orders from 13, or make up some viable defense for the decisions I've made over the last couple of days. In the shop, the counter holds some stale hunks of bread, a wedge of moldy cheese, and half a bottle of mustard. It reminds me that not everyone in the capital has full stomachs these days. I feel obliged to tell Tigress about our remaining food supplies, but she waves my objections away.
I eat next to nothing, she says, and then only raw meat.
This seems a little too in character, but I don't question it. I just scrape the mold off the cheese and divide up the food among the rest of us. While we eat, we watch the latest Capitol news coverage. The government has the rebel survivors narrowed down to the five of us. Huge bounties are offered for information leading to our capture. They emphasize how dangerous we are, show us exchanging gunfire with the peacekeepers, although not the mutts ripping off their heads. Do a tragic tribute to the woman lying where we left her, with my arrow still in her heart. Someone has redone her makeup for the cameras. The rebels let the Capitol broadcast run on uninterrupted. Have the rebels made a statement today? I ask Tigress. She shakes her head. I doubt Coyne knows what to do with me now that I'm still alive. Tigress gives a throaty cackle.
No one knows what to do with you, girlie.
Then she makes me take a pair of the fur leggings, even though I can't pay her for them. It's the kind of gift you have to accept. And anyway, it's cold in that cellar. Downstairs, after supper, we continue to rack our brains for a plan. Nothing good comes up, but we do agree that we can no longer go out as a group of five, and that we should try to infiltrate the president's mansion before I turn myself into bait. I consent to that second point to avoid further argument. If I do decide to give myself up, it won't require anyone else's permission or participation. We change bandages, handcuff Peter back to his support, and settle down to sleep. A few hours later, I slip back into consciousness and become aware of a quiet conversation. Peter and Gale. I can't stop myself from eavesdropping.
Thanks for the water, Peter says.
No problem, Gale replies. I wake up 10 times a night anyway.
To make sure Katniss is still here? Asks Peter.
Something like that, Gale admits.
There's a long pause before Peter speaks again.
That was funny, what Tigress said, about no one knowing what to do with her.
Well, we never have, Gale says.
They both laugh. It's so strange to hear them talking like this, almost like friends, which they're not, never have been, although they're not exactly enemies.
She loves you, you know, says Peter. She's as good as told me after they whipped you.
Don't believe it, Gale answers. The way she kissed you in the Quarter Quell, well, she never kissed me like that.
It was just part of the show,
Peter tells him, although there's an edge of doubt in his voice.
No, you won her over. Gave up everything for her. Maybe that's the only way to convince her you love her.
There's a long pause.
I should have volunteered to take your place in the first games. Protected her then.
You couldn't, says Peter. She'd have never forgiven you. You had to take care of her family. They matter more to her than her life.
Well, it won't be an issue much longer. I think it's unlikely all three of us will be alive at the end of the war. And if we are, I guess it's Katniss's problem. Who to choose?
Gale yawns.
We should get some sleep.
Yeah.
I hear Peter's handcuffs slide down the support as he settles in.
I wonder how she'll make up her mind.
Oh, that I do know.
I can just catch Gale's last words through the layer of fur.
Katniss will pick
whoever she thinks she can't survive without.
Chapter 24. A chill runs through me. Am I really that cold and calculating? Gale didn't say, Katniss will pick whoever it will break her heart to give up, or even whoever she can't live without. Those would have implied I was motivated by a kind of passion. But my best friend predicts I will choose the person who I think I can't survive without. There's not the least indication that love or desire or even compatibility will sway me. I'll just conduct an unfeeling assessment of what my potential mates can offer me, as if in the end it will be the question of whether a baker or a hunter will extend my longevity the most. It's a horrible thing for Gale to say, for Peter not to refute, especially when every emotion I have has been taken and exploited by the Capitol or the rebels. At the moment, the choice would be simple. I can survive just fine without either of them. In the morning, I have no time or energy to nurse wounded feelings. During a pre-dawn breakfast of liver pate and fig cookies, we gather around Tigress's television for one of Beatty's break-ins. There's been a new development in the war. Apparently inspired by the Black Wave, some enterprising rebel commander came up with the idea of confiscating people's abandoned automobiles and sending them unmanned down the streets. The cars don't trigger every pod, but they certainly get the majority. At around 4 in the morning, the rebels began carving 3 separate paths, simply referred to as the A, B, and C lines, to the Capitol's heart. As a result, they've secured block after block with very few casualties.
This can't last, says Gale. In fact, I'm surprised they've kept it going so long. The Capitol will adjust by deactivating specific pods and then manually triggering them when their targets come in range.
Almost within minutes of his prediction, We see this very thing happen on screen. A squad sends a car down a block, setting off four pods. All seems well. Three scouts follow and make it safely to the end of the street. But when a group of 20 rebel soldiers follow them, they're blown to bits by a row of potted rose bushes in front of a flower shop.
I bet it's killing Plutarch not to be in the control room on this one, says Peeta.
Beatty gives the broadcast back to the Capitol, where a grim-faced reporter announces the blocks that civilians are to evacuate. Between her update and the previous story, I am able to mark my paper map to show the relative positions of the opposing armies. I hear scuffling out on the street, move to the windows, and peek out a crack in the shutters. In the early morning light, I see a bizarre spectacle. Refugees from the now occupied blocks are streaming toward the Capitol center. The most panicked are wearing nothing but nightgowns and slippers, while the more prepared are heavily bundled in layers of clothes. They carry everything from lapdogs to jewelry boxes to potted plants. One man in a fluffy robe holds only an overripe banana. Confused, sleepy children stumble along after their parents, most either too stunned or too baffled to cry. Bits of them flash by my line of vision, a pair of wide brown eyes, an arm clutching a favorite doll, a pair of bare feet, bluish in the cold, catching on the uneven paving stones of the alley. Seeing them reminds me of the children of 12 who died fleeing the firebombs. I leave the window. Tigress offers to be our spy for the day, since she's the only one of us without a bounty on her head. After securing us downstairs, she goes out into the Capitol to pick up any helpful information. Down in the cellar, I pace back and forth, driving the others crazy. Something tells me that not taking advantage of the flood of refugees is a mistake. What better cover could we have? On the other hand, every displaced person milling about on the streets means another pair of eyes looking for the five rebels on the loose. Then again, what do we gain by staying here? All we're really doing is depleting our small cache of food and waiting for, what, the rebels to take the capital? It could be weeks before that happens, and I'm not so sure what I'd do if they did. Not run out and greet them. Coin would have me whisked back to 13 before I could say, Nightlock, Nightlock, Nightlock. I did not come all this way and lose all those people to turn myself over to that woman. I kill Snow. Besides, there would be an awful lot of things I couldn't easily explain about the last few days, several of which, if they came to light, would probably blow my deal for the victor's immunity right out of the water. And forget about me. I've got a feeling some of the others are going to need it, like Peeta, who, no matter how you spin it, can be seen on tape tossing Mitchell into that net pod. I can imagine what Coyne's war tribunal will do with that. By late afternoon, we're beginning to get uneasy about Tigress's long absence. Talk turns to the possibilities that she has been apprehended and arrested, turned us in voluntarily, or has simply been injured in the wave of refugees. But around 6 o'clock, we hear her return. There's some shuffling around upstairs, then she opens the panel. The wonderful smell of frying meat fills the air. Tigress has prepared us a hash of chopped ham and potatoes. It's the first hot food we've had in days, and as I wait for her to fill my plate, I'm in danger of actually drooling. As I chew, I try to pay attention to Tigress telling us how she acquired it, but the main thing I absorb is that fur underwear is a valuable trading item at the moment, especially for people who left their homes underdressed. Many are still out on the street trying to find shelter for the night. Those who live in the choice apartments of the inner city have not flung open their doors to house the displaced. On the contrary, most of them bolted their locks, drew their shutters, and pretended to be out. Now the city's circles packed with refugees, and the peacekeepers are going door to door,
breaking into places if they have to assign house guests. On the television, we watch a terse head peacekeeper lay out specific rules regarding how many people per square foot each resident will be expected to take in. He reminds the citizens of the capital that temperatures will drop well below freezing tonight and warns them that their president expects them to be not only willing but enthusiastic hosts in this time of crisis. Then they show some very staged-looking shots of concerned citizens welcoming grateful refugees into their homes. The head peacekeeper says the president himself has ordered part of his mansion readied to receive citizens tomorrow. He adds that shopkeepers should also be prepared to lend their floor space if requested.
"Tigress, that could be you," says Peeta.
I realize he's right, that even this narrow hallway of a shop could be appropriated as the numbers swell. Then we'll be truly trapped in the cellar, in constant danger of discovery. How many days do we have? One? Maybe two? The head peacekeeper comes back with more instructions for the population. It seems that this evening there was an unfortunate incident where a crowd beat to death a young man who resembled Peeta. Henceforth, all rebel sightings are to be reported immediately to authorities who will deal with the identification and arrest of the suspect. They show a photo of the victim. Apart from some obviously bleached curls, he looks about as much like Peeta as I do.
"People have gone wild," Cressida murmurs.
We watch a brief rebel update in which we learn that several more blocks have been taken today. I make note of the intersections on my map and study it.
"Line C is only 4 blocks from here," I announce.
Somehow that fills me with more anxiety than the idea of peacekeepers looking for housing. I become very helpful.
"Let me wash the dishes."
"I'll give you a hand."
Gail collects the plates. I feel Peeta's eyes follow us out of the room. In the cramped kitchen at the back of Tigress's shop, I fill the sink with hot water and suds.
"Do you think it's true," I ask, "that Snow will let refugees into the mansion?"
"I think he has to now, at least for the cameras," says Gail.
"I'm leaving in the morning," I say.
"I'm going with you," Gail says. "What should we do with the others?"
"Pollux and Cressida could be useful. They're good guides," I say.
Pollux and Cressida aren't actually the problem.
"But Peeta's too..."
"Unpredictable," finishes Gail. "Do you think he'd still let us leave him behind?"
"We can make the argument that he'll endanger us," I say. "He might stay here if we're convincing." Peeta's fairly rational about our suggestion. He readily agrees that his company could put the other 4 of us at risk. I'm thinking this may all work out, that he can just sit out the war in Tigress's cellar when he announces he's going out on his own.
"To do what?"
asks Cressida.
"I'm not sure exactly. The one thing that I might still be useful at is causing a diversion. You saw what happened to the man who looked like me," he says.
"What if you lose control?" I say.
"You mean go mutt?" "Well, if I feel that coming on, I'll try to get back here," he assures me.
"And if Snow gets you again?" asks Gale. "You don't even have a gun."
"I'll just have to take my chances," says Peeta. "Like the rest of you."
The two exchange a long look, and then Gale reaches into his breast pocket. He places his nightlock tablet in Peeta's hand. Peeta lets it lay on his open palm, neither rejecting nor accepting it.
"What about you?"
"Don't worry. Beatty showed me how to detonate my explosive arrows by hand. If that fails, I've got my knife, and I'll have Katniss," says Gale with a smile. "She won't give them the satisfaction of taking me alive."
The thought of peacekeepers dragging Gale away starts the tune playing in my head again. Are you coming to the tree?
"Take it, Peeta,"
I say in a strained voice. I reach out,
and close his fingers over the pill. No one will be there to help you. We spend a fitful night, woken by one another's nightmares, minds buzzing with the next day's plans. I'm relieved when 5 o'clock rolls around and we can begin whatever this day holds for us. We eat a mishmash of our remaining food, canned peaches, crackers, and snails, leaving one can of salmon for Tigress as meager thanks for all she's done. The gesture seems to touch her in some way. Her face contorts in an odd expression, and she flies into action. She spends the next hour remaking the 5 of us. She redresses us, so regular clothes hide our uniforms before we even don our coats and cloaks. Covers our military boots with some sort of furry slippers, secures our wigs with pins, cleans off the garish remains of the paint we so hastily applied to our faces, and makes us up again, drapes our outer wear to conceal our weapons. Then gives us handbags and bundles of knick-knacks to carry. In the end, we look exactly like the refugees fleeing the rebels. Never underestimate the power of a brilliant stylist, says Peeta. It's hard to tell, but I think Tigress might actually blush under her stripes. There are no helpful updates on the television, but the alley seems as thick with refugees as the previous morning. Our plan is to slip into the crowd in 3 groups. First, Cressida and Pollux, who will act as guides while keeping a safe lead on us. Then Gale and myself, who intend to position ourselves among the refugees assigned to the mansion today. Then Peeta, who will trail behind us, ready to create a disturbance as needed. Tigress watches through the shutters for the right moment, unbolts the door, and nods to Cressida and Pollux. Take care, Cressida says, and they are gone. We'll be following in a minute. I get out the key, unlock Peeta's cuffs, and stuff them in my pocket. He rubs his wrists, flexes them. I feel a kind of desperation rising up in me. It's like I'm back in the Quarter Quell, with Beatty giving Joanna and me that coil of wire. Listen, I say, don't do anything foolish.
No, it's last resort stuff, completely, he says.
I wrap my arms around his neck, feel his arms hesitate before they embrace me. Not as steady as they once were, but still warm and strong. 1,000 moments surge through me. All the times these arms were my only refuge from the world, perhaps not fully appreciated then, but so sweet in my memory, and now gone forever. All right, then. I release him.
It's time, says Tigress.
I kiss her cheek, fasten my red hooded cloak, pull my scarf up over my nose, and follow Gale out into the frigid air. Sharp, icy snowflakes bite my exposed skin. The rising sun's trying to break through the gloom without much success. There's enough light to see the bundled forms closest to you and little more. Perfect conditions, really, except that I can't locate Cressida and Pollux. Gale and I drop our heads and shuffle along with the refugees. I can hear what I missed peeking through the shutters yesterday. Crying, moaning, labored breathing. And not too far away, gunfire.
Where are we going, Uncle?
A shivering little boy asks a man weighed down with a small safe.
To the President's mansion. They'll assign us a new place to live, puffs the man.
We turn off the alley and spill out onto one of the main avenues.
Stay to the right,
a voice orders, and I see the peacekeepers interspersed throughout the crowd, directing the flow of human traffic. Scared faces peer out of the plate glass windows of the shops, which are already becoming overrun with refugees. At this rate, Tigress may have new house guests by lunch. It was good for everybody that we got out when we did. It's brighter now, even with the snow picking up. I catch sight of Cressida and Pollux about 30 yards ahead of us, plodding along with the crowd. I crane my head around to see if I can locate Peeta. I can't, but I've caught the eye
of an inquisitive-looking little girl in a lemon-yellow coat. I nudge Gale and slow my pace ever so slightly to allow a wall of people to form between us.
"We might need to split up," I say under my breath. "There's a girl." Gunfire rips through the crowd.